This is Revenge of the 90s, a movie podcast. I'm Bronson R. Curry.
I'm Dan Wainio.
And I'm Steve DiMatteo.
And this week we're talking about Boogie Nights.
Everyone's given one special thing, right? Everyone's blessed with one special thing. I want you to know I plan on being a star. A big, bright, shining star.
Eddie Adams from Torrance.
Yep.
Jack Horner, filmmaker. I make exotic pictures.
Boogie Nights. I'll say this about Boogie Nights. I think Boogie Nights is one of those movies that's very, very difficult to not like. I don't think you run across many people who don't like Boogie Nights. Is that fair to say?
I would definitely say that's fair to say. There's so many elements about it that kind of wrap you in, and despite it being tackling some tougher subject matter, I think it's a very enjoyable movie, and the cast is an essential part of that. The cast is so good.
Absolutely. And and it just begins with that opening shot, that like 4 minute long opening shot where you are introduced to every single character in the movie in one fell swoop. And like the whole tone of the movie is just set right there.
That was one of my favorite things about this film, is they had a number of just very long single shots. There's that one with the at the New Year's party when they're rolling into 1980.
Oh yeah. We'll have to talk about that later, because that's something we could talk about for a while.
Yeah.
That's the one take shots in this movie are just amazing. I feel like, I mean, it kind of set Paul Thomas Anderson up for everything he would do after this, but it's so effective in this movie.
I think that's one of the things about this movie, is that when you, technically, this might be like one of the most memorable movies you'll ever see. There aren't many movies where you can just like pinpoint almost 10 shots and be like, this scene was great because of the shot. This was great. Even someone, you know, who doesn't have like a real like technical eye for filmmaking or, you know, shot setup or anything like that. I mean, just like an average viewer, we can sit there and go like, oh, this is great because of this shot, you know? And that's what's so great about it, is that it's so memorable because of just, you know, and I wouldn't say like, you know, a long tracking shot isn't, you know, innovative by any means, but to say, but the what happens in those scenes and the way that they're kind of like intricately designed, I think that's what really sets them apart, obviously.
And I think that style is very important to create this immersive world. Like we feel immersed in this time period. Like I remember reading some review about how, I forget who it was, but about how this was like the first movie outside of the 70s that is about the 70s. Because it creates that immersion.
Isn't it funny that we would have a podcast about 90s movies and right away pick a movie not based in the 90s?
That is pretty funny. And I'll throw the question to someone else on why we did that. Because I think Boogie Nights is a pretty essential 90s movie.
Well, I think we've talked about that before, that by that time period, the 70s were far enough away. You know, that's two decades ago, and so, you know, the 90s was the time where, like, you could start making movies like that, and it would feel nostalgic enough. It would almost feel like a vintage film because, you know, for the 90s, you know, people were saying, like, that was 20-some years ago.
Right, like the 90s are to us now.
Exactly. So for that nostalgic factor that we had for 90s movies, like we've said, it's the same thing where in the 90s you're thinking, like, okay, now we can start looking at the 70s as, like, this historical time period.
And it creates maybe a barrier between that we kind of can comment on the like extravagance and excess of the 70s and 80s that we see in Boogie Nights, because it's in the past. So every scene I feel like shows that excess, and I think it couldn't have been made any year before it was made.
Oh right, no, absolutely. It was at a point where, you know, everything does look from just like a completely different time period, very garish, or, you know, just ridiculous set pieces and, you know, style, hairstyles and that kind of thing. It's a completely different foreign time period to so many people at that point.
So I want to ask, cause I really want to dive into this unbelievable cast in this movie. So I want to start with, just what everyone thought of the ensemble and just who was their favorite characters from this movie.
It was a great cast. It's hard to say favorite character because there's just so many despicable people in this film.
Like who?
I think all of them are pretty
I would argue against that they're despicable people. I would argue that, you know, they're I don't even know if misguided. It's just that they were, you know, in an industry that kind of, see, that's the thing, is that kind of what that movie's about to me is the idea that like pornography is like this smut and this like dirty business that anyone who's associated with that business is just as dirty or as despicable as what is on screen. And I think what's nice about that movie is that it kind of shows that like these are people with like dreams of bigger things, or you know have other aspirations, or just generally like good people or people who have real problems. You know, like Amber Waves, you know, her problem with her child that she couldn't see, it's a very real issue and kind of humanizes her. And even Burt Reynolds' character, you know, as the director, he was so like genuinely interested in making a good film.
And I think
you empathize with him.
And I think it's important that I think you get the sense, especially from Mark Wahlberg's speech when he's accepting his first award, but you get the sense that they all think they're doing important work. And I think that's important because it's tied to how all of them have these big dreams. It's like, I think a lot of the whole American dream drive is in Boogie Nights, in The Rise and Fall.
I think so, absolutely. He says it again, that other line that he talks about when Amber Waves is making that documentary, where he's talking about how he like has saved so many relationships from, you know, people writing him letters and saying like, you've given us this technique, or, you know, you've made our sex life so much better. That's another one of those instances where, you know, they obviously think that they're doing very important work.
I mean, it has to be the warmest, even though Bronson, I kind of see what you say when you find them despicable, but
let me real quick on that. I guess what I mean is, I was talking to someone the other day about Boogie Nights, and they asked, "Oh, what character would you be if you were in this?" and that's where I was just thinking, I don't know that I can really relate to any of them.
Right. That's an interesting question to ask about Boogie Nights. Which one of these, you know, coke heads or porn actresses do you want to be in this?
Right. We all have a very specific like downfall at some point in the movie too.
Right. Actually, I'm pretty sure if I were to choose anyone, I'd probably choose Burt Reynolds, because he sits around and smokes a cigar while people have sex in front of him, and he's pretty rich. Jack Horner's pretty rich. He makes the jump to videotape pretty well. Nothing. All that bad happens to him. He even beats the hell out of a guy on the street and pretty much just walks away from it.
Gets away with it somehow, yeah.
Yeah, just walks away. So I guess I would choose him if I had to choose one person in this movie to be.
Right. That's a great answer.
I think he's, you know, either him or Louis Guzman's character. Luis Guzman's character.
Yeah.
The club owner.
He's really good. So since the movie is so much about the ensemble, let me ask a quick question. So we're following Mark Wahlberg as Dirk Diggler throughout this movie. If the movie centered more on just his character, would it be as enjoyable or as good a movie?
Tell me what you mean by that. Like, what are you thinking would get cut to add more scenes for him?
Because I feel like as is, the story of Dirk Diggler is almost like only 20% of the movie. Like, it's the biggest through line I think we have, and he's the biggest rise and fall from just like, you know, lowly person working at a restaurant to this gigantic star. But I really feel like the movie isn't interested so much in showcasing him as it is everyone in this movie, even Luis right. Guzman and as the club owner, you know, even though he has just like four scenes.
Right. It's I guess it depends on what point of view you want to take from like the other characters. If you're interested enough in these other characters, you know, you kind of like fill in the blanks on you know, Dirk Diggler a little bit, because I thought, you know, in this movie, like his rise and fall is very sudden. you know, all of a sudden he goes from being this, ambitious, kind of like naive kid to all of a sudden being like drugged out and picking a fight where there's no picking a fight with Jack Horner, where there's really no like instigation of that other than maybe a little bit of jealousy from him bringing in someone new. And I think that there are some gaps in that where you kind of just fill it in and go like, yeah, I see where this is heading. And I guess you didn't necessarily need that because now you're filling in with these other characters. So in that regard, you know, I think like we've said, the supporting cast is so good that even a character like John C. Reilly's character, who isn't even, it's not a huge character, but he's like very compelling to watch because he brings like this like dopiness to the character. He's just like a giant doofus.
And it almost turns the movie into a buddy movie at points when it's him and Mark Wahlberg too.
Right, exactly. And then all of a sudden, like Philip Seymour Hoffman becomes like their sidekick to the two of them.
Yeah. I don't know. I guess it does seem like all that supporting cast is pretty essential to the main story of Dirk Diggler. I mean, I wish I had researched it more, but I think Paul Thomas Anderson even mentioned how Boogie Nights is kind of, it's a movie about surrogate family, you know? And I think that's pretty easy to see, that it's just all about people creating their own families.
Absolutely, yeah. Like by the end of it, they're back to being kind of one big happy family.
And you even have certain characters like even asking like, "Will you be my mom?" I'm gonna be your mom, you know.
So last night was the first time I watched Boogie Nights, and as someone new to this film, that scene was, I had no idea what was gonna happen.
I mean, it's dark. There's a that as much as we like as much as that movie has like a happy ending. For the most part,
that's to me the happy ending was like it was almost funny just how quick the turnaround was. That it's like this unexpected, improbable happy ending, and to me it caught me a little by surprise.
That the ending was unexpected for you?
It was a little unexpected, yeah.
Which part of the ending?
Just how so much of the film was, you know, this. Things getting worse and worse, and then it's just like the last 1% of the movie is the happy ending, and I don't know. I don't know what it was about it.
I get that because even that scene where they go to the drug deal that ends up in a shootout, that just sort of like happens and then it's done. And right. I was reading up on the character that Dirk Diggler is like loosely based on, and
John Holmes.
John Holmes, yeah, and his ordeal with that was much more intense. And, you know, it's interesting why they would even have this in the movie. I guess there has to be a breaking point for Mark Wahlberg's character, but they do just kind of gloss over it, where it's like it happens. There's, you know, three people dead in a shootout, and then he just, like, bails and is fine.
It's almost like Paul Thomas Anderson got so, like, it fell so in love with that theme of family that as soon as a couple characters decide like to forgive and forget and reunite, he's just like, okay, that's enough. I'll let you have a happy ending for that. Cause he wanted that so badly.
Right.
You know, what's interesting about that, the end of that scene where Mark Wahlberg is just pushing his car along. The sun has come up, it's day, and he looks off screen and you could tell he's looking at a house. And he goes inside, and you see he's in a house, but you don't quite see who he's looking at. When I saw that, again, the first time I was watching it, I was 100% sure that he had gone back to his parents' house, and that was going to be the ending. And so to me, it was interesting because it really totally closed the door on his old family.
And I think that's interesting that you thought it evoked that, because maybe it's trying to do that, where it's kind of a rebellious teenager coming back to his father figure and making up, you know, and this is his new family. Like, the movie makes no effort to go back to that lost chapter, you know. He can't go back, I think, is the point.
Yeah.
Well, at the same time, you know, for Dirk Diggler, Jack Horner and Amber Waves were the parents that he never really had. I mean, it was pretty obvious from the beginning that his dad was a total wimp and his mom was just this like very pretty abusive woman. So to go, like, as weird as it is, you know, that Jack Horner and Amber Waves represent a fairly, like, in his world, a fairly normal kind of like family dynamic.
And I think it's also interesting that all the characters have, like, shut out their previous families and then found this band of, like, lovable losers to
That's like kind of
a good family.
And that's kind of what it is. I mean, that's just the world of, I think, porn in general. You know, the other thing that I read in the trivia was that the Becky Barnett character, her story ends on a happy note where she gets married to the normal guy, but originally it's written that he abuses her because he gets jealous and angry.
Right,
that,
and there was a scene that was filmed and cut out.
Where
Mark Wahlberg crashes the car. But you know that's interesting that you bring that up because I'd actually written that down to mention. Right before they go and have that shootout scene, they say, "Oh, that'd be enough to get the vet fixed."
Yeah, to fix the vet.
And then they go, and the car is all banged up, and you have no idea of what happened.
Mm-hmm.
I figured that was done entirely on purpose. There was nothing missing, and I loved it that way. There's, you know, this unexplained sort of, his life is going wrong in so many places. This movie doesn't have time to handle it, telling them all.
It works out that way. It definitely is like a kind of like a good accident to have, I think.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting though that he would leave out a scene like that, because that would like completely change the tone of the movie. You know, I think that would like, because most, other than the Colonel, everyone pretty much has a happy ending.
Right.
The Colonel's too busy getting slapped in prison, but other than that, everyone's pretty well off.
But I think the secret to each character's happy ending is that, okay, they've already, you know, closed off their previous family and their previous life, but they can't move on. Every character has to go back to the surrogate family because of the nature of the industry they chose. Like Don Cheadle's character in particular, he tries to escape, but even you see him like at the end, like he's still in the same crowd, and that's how he gets his happy ending, is, you know, he has them filming his commercial, and so he's still maintaining those ties. But he's not running away.
But is this so bad? I think that's the other question. I was like, is it so bad? That's what it also asks.
Yeah.
It's like, it's not that bad at all. These are people who are, a lot of these people are like lost souls. And
right. Ultimately, they found a family that could support them in their own weirdo ways.
Yeah. They're just
I'm trying to remember, was John C. Reilly's ending, none of the other cast was involved in that, were they?
But I think it suggests that he's still keeping, you know, a foot in that scene because of the raciness of his magical act, if you remember.
Right, right.
So I think that he's still heavily in that scene. And isn't he in the final, like, one shot where Burt Reynolds is walking through? Is he in that?
Yeah, he's playing with the baby in the pool.
That's right. So I think everyone is still tied together. And the point is that they're kind of locked in the surrogate family. But as long as they can do it, they can maintain that kind of happiness with each other.
This movie was just so damn tense the whole time.
Yeah? Because
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because you knew something was going to go wrong all the time. Things were so good in the beginning, you knew it was just going to be this long crash through the second half of the film.
That's a good point, because I think the structure of the movie is really interesting. It's in two very distinct halves, where the first half is just, it's almost like it's in a self-contained bubble with very little conflict.
And it's just basically the first half of that movie is just a first half of just like funk music playing all the time.
Right, right. And that first pool party they go to, it's just one great song after another. And it looks like a pretty fun party. Other than that one girl ODing on coke.
Right. But even that's like, even that's handled though in like a real like funny way.
Oh yeah. Oh, I was busting my sides.
That's definitely.
But no, but that's the thing is you saw Mark Wahlberg getting involved. He's this innocent kid. And even in this first half where there's not too much conflict, you still see him getting pulled into this lifestyle that you know is going to be very dangerous. And there's a lot of tension in that. And then in the second half, when things are falling apart, obviously you keep, you know things are just going to keep getting worse. It had me on the edge of my seat the whole time.
Oh, the second half is tense as hell. As soon as it gets to, you know, the scene prior to the cut of, you know, 80s white
yeah.
and black
oh,
text.
Yeah.
Like, that the final William H. Macy sequence leading into the second half of the movie, it's a roller coaster ride for me.
Yeah. And it reminded me of another tense film the three of us have talked about before, Speed. And it got me wondering, which world would you rather live in? The world that the movie Speed could happen in, or this Boogie Nights universe?
That's a tough one. If I'm living in the Speed universe, bus?
You're actively involved with some sort of terrorist plot a la Speed.
So are you suggesting that Boogie Nights is some kind of like thriller?
I'm saying they both made me feel tense in different ways.
Mm.
And I don't know which kind of tension I could put up with better.
If your universe was in Boogie Nights, I feel like there'd always be some secondary scene that it keeps cutting back and forth with while there's pounding music playing. Much like in the scene where Roller Girl is in the cab with Jack and we cut back and forth with Mark Wahlberg.
Right.
That scene alone is when you talk about tension, I mean that was by far the most tense scene of that movie.
I completely agree.
Yeah, I mean I didn't feel like tense so much throughout the movie like you did, Bronson. But that scene was where it flipped it on its, you know, it flipped on its head for me where, you know, it took on a completely different, like you said, Dan, two different halves of a movie.
And it's so simple, and half of it is the music, I think, because the music just is so pounding. But
yeah.
I think the other half is this style that Paul Thomas Anderson kind of grew to fruition in Magnolia, whether you like it or not, where you find the cliffhanger in a conversation, and it can just, like, choke you up because it, like, hits you. Like, there's a scene in the Roller Girl scene where he says, "Hey, I know you. Isn't your name Brandy?" And it just cuts because it knows it's going to hit you in the gut when he says that, and it knows that it can just keep cutting on those cliffhanger moments and keep you tense about the previous scene while it's showing you the next scene.
Right.
So, well, let me ask you guys this real quick. When was the first, how old were you the first time you saw this? How long ago was it?
That's a good question.
A few years ago, maybe?
Mm-hmm.
I was maybe like 17.
Yeah. So, last night being the first time I saw this, I gotta say the whole thing, like I was saying earlier, the whole thing was tense. At no point did I know what was gonna happen. That scene where, with the, I'm gonna ask if you're my mom, and you just say yes. You just say yes, you're my mom. That scene?
Yeah.
I was so on the edge of my seat. I thought one of them was gonna overdose and die, or they were gonna start making out with each other, hooking up. I had no idea. I didn't know what was gonna happen.
I bet you would have liked it if the latter happened.
I would have had mixed feelings about it.
the same way when Julianne Moore tells Dirk Diggler how much she loves him, and then they just start going at it.
Yeah, there was some pretty
some interesting, an interesting family dynamic
stuff there.
Absolutely.
Right.
I think now that you say that, Bronson, I really wish I could undo my memory, because maybe I was just like relaxed through the movie, because I knew I had that safety knowing that the first half is like this hermetic bubble where it's all rise, you know. But if you didn't have that safety going in, I bet you know it's around the corner.
I don't know, because it had been long enough that between the times that I've seen this movie that I kind of forgot everything about it. And I didn't have that same, for whatever reason, I didn't have that same level of tension that you did. I did at the right moments, like I did, you know.
They were the right moments for you, but it was just wrong to be tense all the time.
Paul Thomas Anderson would be really, really disappointed in what you're saying right now if you heard this. It's a good thing we don't have him on. We almost booked him for this, and I'm really glad that he bailed. But no, you know, I don't know what it is. I think it's because at the end of the day, I just thought that it would end well for everybody because everything about the like family atmosphere of the first half led me to believe that like, even though there's a bunch of craziness is happening, I still thought they'd all come together in the end. And I don't know what it was, but that's just like, you know, that's kind of like how families are. You know, families will like, and of course, you know, I'm generalizing, but families will fight or families will become estranged from each other for however long. And I think most of the time they come back together and things are fairly normal or, you know, kind of it's water under the bridge. And I you know, thought at some point it would come and to reach that resolution, but that was just how I felt when I was watching it.
Yeah.
And I think it's that theme of family, but there's also just, the movie is a comedy, I think. And there's so many elements of comic relief, even when it is tense. I mean, you can't ignore just like the absurdity of the whole, like, of just the movies they're making. And I mean, oh my God, what's his name that he comes up with for his action hero character?
Brock Landers.
That's it. Yeah. Like the Brock Landers films are just so over the top and amazing.
Oh, they're hilarious.
Anytime John C. Reilly is usually on screen, he's the biggest comic relief character, I think.
Oh, definitely.
That's what's so great. That's what's so great about seeing him in comedies now. And seeing his career transformation from either comedic relief in a drama or a straight dramatic role. I mean, you can see how easy it was for him to just jump into like absurd comedy.
Yeah.
Yeah. His first scene in this where they're talking about like what you can squat.
Yeah.
And what you can bench. Oh, it's just fantastic.
That's one of the best like long takes just because it's just them talking.
Now, what we can talk about, what you wanted to talk about previously, Dan, is we can talk about that William H. Macy scene.
Oh, I think that's pretty essential. I think, go on.
I was just, well, when you said it's essential, I mean, I think that's, if people usually pick out one scene from this movie that they can really remember, I think that's usually it. For obvious reasons.
Yeah, part of it is just, it's such a jump. I feel like that's the first act of violence in a pretty violent movie,
and well, yeah, and that's until and that sets you up. I mean, that just sets you up for what the second. I mean, that's basically the end of the good times, and sets you up for what's going to be that tense second half.
And it takes you by surprise because it's set up initially as if it's just comic relief. Like it works in the kind of comedy of threes where we see him and the situation with his wife. The first two times, and it's like goofy and funny, and it's played for laughs, but then it like just turns so quickly in the third scene.
Right.
And I think
Bronson, as someone who had never seen it before, what did you think that was what he was going to do?
You know, I that one actually didn't take me by surprise. As soon as he went out to his car and he got the gun and. All I could think was like, oh, finally he's doing something about this.
he's being a man about it.
Now, why he didn't just get a divorce, I'll never know.
I don't know. I think that's a pretty traumatizing thing for you to walk in on your wife like that and see her doing it in public.
I like to think about what William H. Macy's past is with, like, just from the suggestions we get in this movie, because it's obvious that he married. I think it's obvious that he married like one of the performers, and he probably thought he was like a hotshot, you know. And then, like, this is what happens after all of it.
Right. And well, and the actress that played his promiscuous wife was played by real life porn star Nina Hartley, according to IMDb trivia.
There you go.
I did not know that.
They actually
well, do your homework trivia. Next time we do a podcast.
I'll do my best.
But yeah, that's a good, I think that's probably, I mean, I would think maybe partly why they got rid of the scene, where Becky's character, is abused by her new husband, because I don't know if they necessarily want to portray that, you know, every single one of those relationships doesn't work out, that every single type of porn star slash regular person relationship is always going to go up in flames. But I mean, is that, you know, it's like, is that what they wanted to do? Is that what did they want to show that kind of dynamic, or that kind of like, I don't know, the two opposite situations? Or was William H. Macy just a disposable enough character that you could just get away with losing him? Do you know what I mean?
I think he's kind of the harbinger in this movie of the darkness. You know, like it's the reminder that, hey, all of this looks pretty fun, but it's inevitable that because of the high stakes of the excitement, there's going to be some darkness brewing underneath.
And that's funny you say that, because even in that first half, he's really the only dark character of that first half of that movie.
Yeah, he's the only one who's like seems pretty miserable with his life. Everyone else is pretty happy to be there,
having an amazing time.
Yeah,
sure.
So, how long a period passed during this movie? Like, how old was Mark Wahlberg's character at the end of the film?
I think like he's 24.
24?
Yeah. I think it's a 7-year period.
Well, I'm 24 and I haven't done anything like that. Now I'm starting to feel like I'm missing out.
Do you have, I mean, this is, you know, this is probably not podcast material, but I'm willing to bet you don't have, you're not as well endowed as Dirk Diggler. I think that's your problem.
You know, according to IMDb trivia, Mark Wahlberg got to keep that prosthetic that he pulls out at the end of the film as a souvenir of the movie.
How many times do you think he's brought that out at like a party?
I hope commonly.
I hope enough that people have gotten tired of it. That's what I hope.
Well,
so I think we're all in agreement that Boogie Nights is a pretty amazing movie for the 90s, but amazing overall. I think if you know you're looking back, it's probably one of the most important movies of that decade.
And it was a big success. Yeah, I love it. I love this movie.
Would you think, now here's a question that is always fun to ask. Would it do well now? Would Boogie Nights do well now?
I don't know whether it would get made, one, but...
do you think is there like a tighter grip on these, like, you know, I guess... a movie that's as like obscene as this one? I mean, is there like a tighter grip on that these days? I know that they're making what's her name? Linda Lovelace, was that her name?
Oh yeah, yeah, they're going to do a movie
they're
about
making
her.
Movie. They've been making a few about her now, aren't they? And you know, you wonder how those will turn out, but you know, do you think that there are more people like would wince at the kind of things that were in this movie in the 90s?
I'm really glad you brought that up, because I think there's a difference. I think a movie like about Lovelace, or you know, Lovelace will be made because it shows the dark parts about it and it focuses on that. I don't know if Boogie Nights would necessarily get greenlit in this year, because it celebrates it in a certain way, or at least could be seen as celebrating or condoning it. And I think that's seen as edgier than just diving into the darkness and all, you know,
right,
and the grit. And so I don't know when is the most recent movie that I've seen that takes on such subject matter but allows it to have its own life and show you why some people think it's exciting.
Right. All right. I think we've exhausted the topic of Boogie Nights.
All right. That's all anyone ever will have to say about this.
put that one in the vault. All that's been said about it has been said. All
right. Well, is Magnolia a 1999 movie? Is that a movie that might pop up in the?
It is. It most certainly is.
All right, then.
So we'll be revisiting Paul Thomas Anderson soon.
All right. Well, I can't wait to continue this discussion.
Neither can I, boys.
What are we doing next week?
Next week we'll be covering The Blair Witch Project, a film I haven't seen since it first came out on, well, I don't know, probably VHS back in whatever year Blair Witch Project was released.
1999.
Oh, the same year as The Matrix.
1999 is one of the best years for movies across the board. And I think we'll probably talk about that a lot on this particular podcast.
Yeah, I imagine that'll come up every now and then.
Well, right. Then I guess that wraps it up for Revenge of the 90s this week. This is Bronson R. Curry.
This is Dan Wainio.
And this is Steve DiMatteo.
Saying thanks for tuning in.
Boogie Nights. And Boogie Nights music fading us out.
Just like some like cool funk song, just like.
Yeah. That's really what we should do.